Hello, welcome back to Emory University's Creativity Conversation podcast. My name is Maggie Becker. I am an Emory alum in theater studies and creative writing. I work with Arts at Emory, a communications and advocate team for all the arts events that occur on Emory University's campus. Part of my work with Arts at Emory is producing these podcasts. These podcasts are pulled from live recordings of Rosemary McGee Creativity Conversations, an endowed speaker series where renowned thinkers and creators come into conversation about their craft on Emory's campus. I'm joined today by Stipe scholar Austin Wohlers to introduce and talk about the 2013 Rosemary McGee Creativity Conversation with Philip Glass.
Hi, I'm Austin Wohlers. I'm the 2018 to 2019 Stipe scholar for creative writing. I'm a senior in the college, and I'm a major in creative writing and comparative literature.
Austin, why were you interested in this 2013 Philip Glass creativity conversation?
So I'm in an honors seminar right now where a lot of us are talking about, you know, our different creative processes and whatnot. But I think oftentimes as artists, we tend to only stick to hearing about the creative processes and the like inspiration and the working methods of people in our discipline. So I was interested in watching this because this talk is all about, you know, Philip Glass's creative process, and I think we have a lot to learn from people of other disciplines as well. I also have an interest in music, so it was a little bit maybe more relevant to me than watching something totally outside of your discipline.
How would you describe Philip Glass's creative process?
It seems pretty unique, and like he takes things from a lot of different people, and like especially the people around him, which I think is really good. And I've also found that to be the case. Like you have this idea of somebody like sitting in a room and just doing things all by themselves, but you end up taking things a lot from people sort of in your sphere as well.
And so you're in you said you were in an honors class. What mm-hmm. does that entail?
It's a seminar for creative writing honors students who are writing an honors thesis.
Wow. So you're working on an honors thesis then?
Yeah, I am. It's a novel about a woman who leaves an unsatisfying life in the city to go and move to an orchard, which was left to her in a will. But she screws it up because she's bad at farming, and then she gets mauled by a bear.
Oh my goodness. That's very like Shakespearean.
Yeah.
And Chekhovian, I guess. Yeah. Cherry Orchard. So what is your creative process?
I guess when you're growing up, you have a lot of the, you know, you want inspiration to strike you sort of mentality. But this year especially, and like even in college, like I haven't had that necessarily. Like I've known that, you know, even if you don't really feel like it, sometimes you just have to sit down and work. But I still would try to wait until I was at least kind of like in a good mood. But for this project, I've just had to work on it every day. And some days I like really have not wanted to work on it, but it's, you know, you just got to do it. So I think this year, I mean, I felt more like a writer than ever because I've sort of learned that even like no matter what, I can sit down and like, even if someday it's difficult, access this thing and that there is this like well of like potential energy that can be like extracted.
You're a musician as well. Are you part of a band?
Yeah, I've been working on some solo ambient music myself, but I haven't really done anything with it yet. It's just been alone. And I also play synth in a band with my boyfriend and two of our friends called Paradise Montage. And Jameson and I, my boyfriend, also had like a library music type project, which I guess would be the most similar to the Philip Glass stuff of everything I'm involved with. But I would say right now I'm focusing on the thesis and also playing in the band. And after I finish the first draft of the novel, I wanted to do some stuff with the ambient music until I have to come back to the novel in spring.
Sure, because it gives you like a break. I sometimes find switching between things will help me actually develop my own creative process in the other project more.
Yeah, no, for sure. And also like I used to be like, oh, you know, like every day I can like do some writing and then do some music and it'd be whatever. But it's so hard to like flip around like that. So I found that the only way that I can really make that work is by like doing a long project in one and then doing a long project in the other. And like it can't be like an hourly thing. It's more of like a weekly or even monthly kind of switch off.
How do you think this Philip Glass conversation will affect your next process, your next step in your thesis?
Right now, I'm trying to close out the thesis, so I don't know that it necessarily will have a lot of impact on it. But I mean, in the future, it's just another great addition to like the collage of inspirations we're always assembling.
Did anything stick out to you about this conversation?
I think I was surprised at how like, I guess I'm always sort of surprised at this, but I'm surprised at how friendly he was. I liked that. I think we have this impression of artists we like is very serious, but then they're just like laughing about, I don't know. For some reason, it kind of reminded me of this one David Lynch video where he's talking about making quinoa. He's like, I like to step outside and like, while the quinoa is simmering and all the little quinoas are bubbling away. And I think that process of demythologizing is really important. And like, if only for like realizing that like, you know, the people that you admire, like someone is, you know, famous and influential as Philip Glass is just like a dude can be helpful to your own creative, because it's like, okay, I can do this too. Like, I like to watch, you know, Sons of Anarchy every night. Like, it doesn't mean I can't be an artist, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. And I think also, you know, you're talking about when you were younger and you thought that it was just supposed to strike you and you were supposed to sit down and do it, that there is life in artists that are, is like a true human life.
Yeah,
not just
truly.
Like waiting around for inspiration to strike.
and like mysteriously avoiding interviews and like speaking cryptically.
Yes. Yeah. Well, good luck on your thesis. I'm very excited to read it. Please enjoy this 2013 Rosemary McGee Creativity Conversation with Philip Glass.
Thanks so much.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for coming out on this afternoon. Welcome to the Short Center for Performing Arts. My name is Katie Pittman. I'm the Associate Director here. I'm just so glad that you're here to join us for this creativity conversation. Dr. Richard Pryor is the Edward Goodwin Scruggs Conducting Chair, Senior Lecturer, and Director of Orchestral Studies for Emory University, where he conducts the Emory University Symphony Orchestra and the Emory Youth Orchestra. Dr. Pryor is also the Georgia Power Conducting Chair and the Music Director and Conductor of the Rome Symphony Orchestra in Rome, Georgia. Richard Pryor's musical training began in his native England, where he received a BA with high honors at Leeds University and a doctorate in conducting and composition from Nottingham University. Highly active as a composer, his music has been performed, recorded, and broadcast widely in Europe and North America. Our guest, Philip Glass, was born in Baltimore, Maryland, and is a graduate of the University of Chicago and the Juilliard School. In the early 1960s, he spent 2 years of intensive study in Paris with Nadja Boulanger, and while there, earned money by transcribing Ravi Shankar's Indian music into Western notation. By 1974, Glass had a number of innovative projects, creating a large collection of new music for the Philip Glass Ensemble and for the Mabu Mines Theater Company. This period culminated in Music in 12 Parts and the landmark opera Einstein on the Beach, for which he collaborated with Robert Wilson. Since Einstein, Glass has expanded his repertoire to include music for opera, dance, theater, chamber ensemble, orchestra, and film. His scores have received Academy Award nominations for Kundun, The Hours, and Notes on a Scandal, and a Golden Globe for The Truman Show. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Richard Pryor and Philip Glass.
Well, good afternoon and a very warm welcome to the Schwartz Center and our wonderful special guest, Mr. Philip Glass. We're going to kind of engage with a number of talking points here and questions that are either from my own mind or from that of my students. See kind of where the conversation takes us for sure. But again, welcome, Philip.
Thank you, Richard.
It's wonderful to have you back. So you studied with the great Nadja Boulanger in the 1960s, and she was a friend and mentor to some of the greatest names, I think, in conducting and composing, from Stravinsky to Copland, Quincy Jones, Astor Piazzolla. What was she really like, and why was she such a lightning rod for those key figures?
You know, I really have to talk about it in terms of my, I don't know what she was like with other people. To me, she was terrifying. During that time, I was in the 60s, and during that time, I was also working with Ravi Shankar. I took a day job. I took a notating music for him, and I began working with him at the same time. That I was actually his assistant, but he was always teaching. So at one point, I had these two teachers. I had her, and I had Ravi Shankar. And I thought of them literally as two angels, one on my left shoulder, one on my right shoulder, and one taught with fear, and one taught through love. So I'm saying more, but... She wasn't the one that taught with love. Now, she loved teaching, but her way of expressing it was she wanted to bring the best out of her students. And it was a very tough period. I saw her 3 or 4 times a week because she arranged it that way. You had a private lesson, then you had the Wednesday, which was a big class, so with anyone who happened to be in Paris that was a former student. And there was always a big project for the year. It could have been the Mozart concertos or whatever. She would pick a topic like that, and you did it for the whole year. And the third time I saw her was what we call the Black Thursday class. You heard about that. Then I had a fourth lesson with her assistant teacher, and that was Mademoiselle Dudenay, which is a great name for a teacher. The gift of God, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, they were quite a pair. She was in charge of all the Renaissance music. Mm-hmm. And then Mademoiselle Boulanger took care of everything up to the present. But basically, it was my training with her, and I had finished Juilliard already. I had a master's degree, or whatever that. You know, these degrees don't mean that much, but I met some wonderful people there, and I worked with some, and many of them were just other students, by the way. And some were the teachers, and some were people that I didn't work with, but I admired and was around them in certain ways. But when I finished at Juilliard, I was maybe 24, 25. I stayed there a long time. And I ended up going to Paris to study with her. Because the reason was that my best teacher at Juilliard was actually a fellow student. I took a secret private lessons from him. Shirley Verrett Carter, Shirley Verrett, she was his other secret student. We didn't tell anybody, and they were free lessons, of course. And after a while, I said, oh, okay, Albert, who did you study with? And it turned out to be Boulanger. And then he said, well, if you want to, I'll write a letter for you, and he did. I ended up there. What she did with me was almost entirely technique. She didn't look at music.
Interesting. So I've read accounts in your book, Opera on the Beach, of the infamous Black Thursdays. Could you give us an insight the audience as
you know,
to what
the
those
thing
were?
Is that you have to look at it from another way. What she was trying to do, and I thought about this a lot. I mean, those years I spent with her were definitive in terms of what I was able to do. Graduated from a well-known conservatory, but I didn't have the technique that I needed. And I had the degree, but I didn't have what the degree was supposed to represent. Maybe that it can happen to anybody. It might be happening to you right now. I don't know. But the degrees are easy to get. The technique is harder to get.
Couldn't agree more. I mean, the degrees basically sort of set you up, and then what you need to do is go out into the world and
compose.
Well,
you accomplish it. Yeah. The task is set before you, and then you, with luck and perseverance and stamina, and desperation, you accomplish it somehow. So anyway, mostly I worked in the morning from 7 in the morning till it was dark when I began and dark when I ended. I easily put in a 9 or 10 hour day. To accomplish, I practically stopped writing, which is very hard for me to do. I never stopped writing, but I did during that time. The Black Thursday, you want to hear about that?
Yes.
Well, you see, what she was really trying to do, I believe, there were two things. One was to develop the ability in you to actually visualize music in your head, to actually hear it. In other words, and this is a very, you know, it's the most important thing. It sounds like everybody would know that, but we don't know that. And it's not only true for composers, it's true for performers. It's equally true and as important, if not more important, that the fundamental activity of the musician is to listen and to hear. When you're playing, and I play, and what you're conducting, the same thing. Is it the same? I don't do any conducting.
Yes and no. It depends what you're conducting and what's happening at the time. But, I mean, I think the skill sets for a composer are actually very, very close to that of a conductor.
Yeah, I found that to be true. With the one difference is that I find that conductors can rarely find the wrong notes, but the composer can. If you know what I mean. Well, that's a whole other conversation. But what she was trying to do was to develop the ability to really hear music very clearly. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you one exercise that she gave us there were only 6 or 7 students in the Black Thursday class. We were convinced that we were a mixture of the best and the worst students, but we didn't know who was who. By the time the 3-hour class, it was 9 to 12, by the time it got to be 12 o'clock, she pretty much had destroyed everybody at that point. I remember one day we went in, there was a line of music in tenor club, of course. The first thing you had to do was, she expected you to know all 7 clefs. And that, so, and
7.
That was to help you in transposing. That once you know the clefs, then you simply read the music in the new clef, adding the appropriate number of sharps and flats, and transposition became very easy then. So you had to know. So first of all, and she would say, Daniel, sing the soprano part. So he would sing. No, you don't get to write anything down. So he sang the soprano part. She said, Peter, can you do the alto? Now, Peter's job was to remember what Danielle had written, had composed, which was not, it was all sung. Nothing was even played on the piano. So he sang. And then she went, that took a while. That could take hours. Because usually someone could only accomplish maybe 1 or 2 notes, and it was exhausting, and then she'd just get somebody else, and she just cycled through this small group of people. So by the time we got to the last, the baseline, she said, okay, now, of course, the bass is easy because you've heard the other three, right? But that's providing you remember the other three. Now, you know, here's a funny thing. A little bit later, I was working with Ravi Shankar on a film score that he was doing. We were at the recording studio in the Champs-Élysées, and there were about 12 or 15 musicians, French musicians there. I was hired because I spoke French, and I could read music, and I got the job. Even the basic idea of the notation, I had to solve that within about 20 minutes. It wasn't, you know, it was really, this was a tough, I got very lucky, and I was able to get through a lot of these things. But what he did was this. He said, okay, the oboe, and he played the sitar, he said, the oboe plays this, and he played it, and I wrote it down. And I gave that to the oboe. He said, we'll have the first violin play this, and he went through the orchestra. Nothing was written down, except the parts, which I handed out to the players. And he said, now, Philip, you conduct. Well, fortunately, I was a Boulanger student, and I could do it. But if I hadn't had that, I mean, being able to hear, I could remember it. It wasn't that hard, and I was able to do it. And then there was no score. The score, there were the parts. Now, by the way, very shortly after that, I ended up in New York, and I started my own ensemble. I was writing pieces like Music in Fifths and Music in Similar Motion, and even I Stand on the Beach. The first 10 years of writing for the ensemble, I didn't have a score. The reason I didn't was because I knew, without a shadow of a doubt, that no one was going to look at the score anyway. I was not interested in writing a score and then doing all the parts, so I actually just wrote the parts out. Music in 12 parts, there was never a score until later someone took all the parts and they made the score. Same with Einstein. The original Einstein, I had my part, I wrote my part out, and then I wrote all the other parts out. I actually carried that on for 10 years into my professional life. I had been studying for a couple of years by now, and she could speed read, by the way. She would go like this, boom, 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 and then she could find mistakes. And if she found one, she sent you home. That was the end of the lesson. That only happened once, by the way. And after that, you didn't make any more mistakes. No. I brought in this music, and she said, resolution of the soprano is incorrect. I said, Mademoiselle Boulanger is correct. I was, you know, with her a couple, number of years. I thought I knew what I was doing. She said, no, that's correct. She said, no, it's incorrect. I said, no. And I looked at it carefully. No, it's correct. And then she pulled an amazing stunt. I don't know how she did this. She reached behind the piano, the music rack, took a Mozart violin piano sonata, opened it up to where she knew. I don't know how that. She rehearsed this whole routine. I don't know. But it seemed very spontaneous. She opened it up. She pointed it to it and said, look. I said, oh, Mozart resolved the soprano part on the third. I almost fainted. I said, no, I thought I knew all the rules. Understood almost instantly that we were now on a different playing field. Basically, what she was saying was that the personal style is a special case of technique. In other words, there are a lot of ways of doing that correctly, but she wanted the Mozart version. Well, she didn't even tell me that, but I was supposed to...
psychically
I was supposed to know it. But her criticism was that the correct resolution would have been the one that Mozart had done, and I had done the wrong one. If a personal style is a special case of technique, then you have to have the technique to begin with. If you don't have it, then you don't have... If you listen to Rachmaninoff or Beethoven or anybody, you listen to two chords next to each other, you know who the composer is. Why do you know that? You know it because the composer is applying his own, let's say, his predilection for resolving the voice leading in a certain way. Rachmaninoff did it that way. And basically what she was saying... And she didn't ever say it. She said, okay, now you've learned the technique, but now to develop a personal style is a special case of that. And without that, you won't be able to do it.
Absolutely. Early in my career, I had a composition teacher, Alan Ridout, in England, who the one thing I remember from him was he said, you know, there are no such things as rules in music, which, of course, was news to me, having studied, you know, don't write parallel fifths and all that sort of thing. And the caveat was no such things as rules. There are only principles of style. So,
well, that's very much the same. She had moved, first of all, she banged the rules into my head so that it was impossible not to know them. There were so many ways of doing it. And the Black Thursday class was a whole series of things like that. Usually at the end of the at the Black Thursday Classic, she says, well, I'm really sorry that we had to spend the day on this really stupid exercise because I really had something else to do today, but it just took all day to do it. Because we never, that happened every time. She had all kinds of tricks like that. When I became more of a performer myself, and I began to understand that quality of playing had to do with the attention I made to listening. And I'm talking about my music. I found that I was, this is what happened to me, I would be playing in front of people. And I found that I was playing differently. I played something in a different way, the pedals were different, the tempo was, I said, well, what the hell am I doing? And what I was doing, I was listening to the piece in a different way. Mm. And that had the unnerving occurrence what happened in front of, you know, hundreds if not thousands of people. Mm. And I understood from that, that's what I said, the second part is about listening. Mm. It's about that. And that, and I learned that from, not from a musician, I learned that from a sculptor. I was working in my, I had day jobs until I was in my 40s. One of my day jobs was a very good one. I was working for a very well-known sculptor. He was a friend of mine, actually. He needed some help. And I worked for him. And he liked me because I wasn't an artist, so that whatever secrets or whatever, I wasn't going to take any of his ideas. I wasn't going to make any sculpture. Mm-hmm. And we got along very well. And one day I was working with this guy, and he said, I said, you know, Richard, I never learned to draw. I wish I could draw. And he said, oh, I can teach you to draw. I said, really? Well, how would you do that? He said, I'll teach you to see, and when you can see, then you'll know how to draw.
Huh. That's great.
And by the way, we were too busy. I never had a chance to, we never did it, and I never learned to draw. Yeah. But when he said that, I understood the corollaries. Painting is about seeing, sculpture is about seeing. Dancing is about moving. Poetry is about speaking. And music is about listening. Mm-hmm. Those are the essential and profoundly essential functions that you need to work with. After that, when I began playing, I began listening to my playing. And I began playing in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a great skill. We often talk about, you know, there's a difference between you sometimes just hearing as opposed to really
Let's go into this question a little more deeply.
Okay.
When do you do the hearing? Is it after you play the note, when you play the note, or before you play the note?
Yes.
You exactly. It's the damnedest thing. I think that you do all three.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
And that you develop a kind of funny kind of attention where you can say, oh, I'm here, I was there, this is happening, I'm going. The thought is as quick as lightning, fortunately, mm-hmm. because the notes are coming all the time.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. I think this is where one of the crossovers really happens in sort of the conducting and composing world, because we think of ourselves as in three different time zones. You're in the present, you're looking ahead to see what's coming up, and you're also analyzing
exactly.
what just happened. So I couldn't agree more. The answer is yes.
Yeah, the answer is yes. So working with her, after I had begun music when I was six, so by the time I was, I was in music school far too long. I had been studying music by that point about 20 years. That's, one of the reasons I never became a teacher was I had just been to school too long. I couldn't take it anymore. I was done. But besides which, my mother was a school teacher, and I wanted to get away from all the school teachers, and I didn't want to go to school and teach. But the interesting thing is how important those teachers can be. Those in your life as a musician, they'll be, it could be your major teacher, it could be someone that you admired but never really studied with, it could be someone who really brought you to a level of attention. Mm-hmm. In terms of the work, where you could go beyond what you were capable of, mm-hmm. or you could go beyond what you thought you were capable of.
Great.
Did you have some questions there, Richard? Sorry.
It's all good. Let me move to this. So you are arguably best known for what people kind of apply as the label of minimalism. And it's a term that I certainly understand from my perspective that you've distanced yourself from.
Well, it's not that I've distanced myself. The music has distanced itself. That's the problem. Let's say you're a writer and you're I'm coming to town with a big symphony. And then you introduce the idea to the reader, to the listeners, that they're going to hear a minimalist symphony. And then they hear symphony number 9, they're going to say, what?
Well, interesting. So, I mean, would it be more accurate to say, is the catch-all that it's essentially more music that uses cyclical or repetitive structures?
No. I wouldn't go there at all. When people say, what kind of music you write? I say, I write theater music. That has the virtue of being actually truthful. I would say 75% of the work, there are dances, there are films, there are operas. There are things that, now, what is the distinctive thing about theater work is collaborative work. It involves the four: music, movement, text, and image. Those are the four. It's like the earth, air, fire, water. That's what it is. Dance may only use two, or opera uses all four. So do films, by the way. What's interesting about that is that it places that description places the music in the very place that it exists in. I'm in the opera house, I'm in the ballet house, I'm in the movie house, that's where I'm working. So I get to know someone just a little bit, and they say, oh, you're a composer, what kind of music you write? The easiest thing to say is, I write film music. And I usually do say that, because chances are they've heard something, and they said, well, what did you do? And I said, well, did you see The Illusionist, or did you see, you know, and said, oh, you did that. So I'm not going to say I write string quartets, so what good is that? It's not going to help anybody. I mean, perhaps. I've written a lot of string quartets, by the way. But when we talk about how do we function in the world, when I say I'm a theater composer, that tells you much more than when I say I'm cyclical, blah, 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 blah. Pardon me. Oh, yeah. And no one really cares about that stuff anyway. It's, I think, more interesting to come up with an answer that perhaps is illuminating.
No, and one of my questions is, I mean, given that you have done, you know, kind of, you know, a real high number of film scores that are, you know, highly recognizable, successful, what are your thoughts about the relationship between music and film as an expressive medium?
I was once talking to a group of composers in Hollywood once that there's either a club or a guild or something, but all the film composers, a lot of them know each other, and they get together and they talk about music, believe it or not. And I was asked to give a talk. I had gotten a nomination for maybe The Hours or something like that. And they said, "Help, Phil, what is the difference between opera and film?" And I said, I thought about that, and I said, well, not much. However, the most important difference is the nature of the workplace. I said, what do you mean? I said, well, when I'm running a film score, the person who is in charge of that is the director or the producer, now these days the producer, or sometimes the marketing people. They'll tell you when to do the rewrite. When I work at a dance house, it's the choreographer. When I'm running music for a play, it's the director. Now, the composer's house is actually the opera house. Now, this is how the opera house, this is why people like to write operas. When I am invited to write an opera, the first thing we do is decide who the director will be, and I say we, because I have to approve the director. Now, once we have the director and I will decide on the designer. The designer and the director will choose the lighting designer. No auditions are made without my presence or unless I pass. I will go, actually what I do is I go to the first, I don't go to the first auditions. I said, when you get down to 10 people, call me. I don't want to hear 30 people sing a part. I mean, this is not interested. So I'll go for the end of the auditions, and then I'll go back for the first vocal rehearsals, because I want to hear, if anyone has a problem with the voices, where it's not too high, or someone will say, you know, I really don't have that note, but I really sound good here, that's the time to change it. And there's no reason not to. I mean, this is the person who's going to sing the piece on your opening night. I'm going to make it sound as good as I can. Then I go away because the director really doesn't want me to watch what he's doing. And I come back for the first orchestra dress rehearsal, at which point I can start seeing the staging. And I'll stay for the last week of rehearsals, I'll stay for the whole week. And then we get right up to the dress rehearsal. So when I say the difference is the rules of the workplace. If you don't understand the rules, you are really going to get into trouble. In other words, you can't win an argument with the director. And if you get upset about it and say, and your feelings are hurt, and you said, oh, I wrote this great masterpiece and I'll have to rewrite it, forget it. You shouldn't be doing the job. It's not going to happen. Now, what you can do These are called the alttext. You can take them and do something else with them. They'll never remember them anyway. Strictly speaking, the phone company owns everything, but they don't know what they own. They don't know what they don't know, if you know what I mean. So, I'll tell you a funny story. I did a dance for, there was a guy named Oscar Kumpfer. He was a designer, and he made a dance in the early 1900s, the Triadic Ballet, and it was never done. There was a composer, everything was done, but they never produced it. 40, 50 years later, his grandson asked me to write the score. They just lost their money, but I hadn't done the whole score. So then another ballet company said they wanted a ballet. I said, I've got one. And I sold it to them the second time. They went out of business, too. Dance companies do this all the time. And then finally, a film company in South Africa wanted a score. I sold it the third time. And I think it worked. So the good news about this is that if someone doesn't like, it's not the end of the world. Mm. That piece can end up, if you like the piece, if it has some quality to it, it could very well become part of something else.
Mm-hmm. So this is a question that certainly a number of the composition students were kind of dying to ask because they're wrestling with this kind of right now. When you start a new piece, you have such a kind of highly recognizable or instantly recognizable, almost kind of iconic style that's sort of in place. How do you begin? I mean, when you've got kind of the blank canvas, I mean, what are your thoughts and how do you get started?
Since a lot of the work is theater work, I start with the text. Mm-hmm. Most of the time I'm doing that. When I'm writing symphonies, I'm not doing that. Then the exercise is different. It's certainly easier when you're working in that way. But then, of course, when you're writing a string quartet, you don't have a text. So you're still back to that question. Mm-hmm. So let me give you something that will be helpful, I think, to you or to anybody, really. It was helpful to me, actually. Mm-hmm. And it's something I was working on very recently. I was writing a piece for four pianos, which is a ridiculous thing to do. Because you think no one's going to play it, but people are playing it. So it turns out that it maybe isn't so silly, but it's not so easy to do. And I was checking the notes. I write pencil and paper, mm-hmm. and then I have a couple of young people who will put it in the computer, and then at that point we make parts, and we can also look for corrections because I can play back the computer version mm-hmm. with the score, and I can hear the wrong notes, and we can fix the notes. But sometimes the notes can either be wrong because they're copied wrong or because the composer wrote them wrong. It's about half, I would say, and I always tell my copy, I said, you know, half of the mistakes are mine and half are yours. So let's forget about, don't even apologize. Let's just fix the notes. Then the conductors who get involved, and they'll say, you know, Philip, that's the wrong note. I said, no, it's not. And you know, we get into that. Okay, but I won't even tell you about that right now. So I was proofreading this piece, and they hadn't played it yet. So I wanted to make sure the notes were right. I was sitting there, and I was looking at the score. And I kind of drifted off in some way, and I was still looking at the score, and I looked at it, and I said, my God, what the hell is this? And I said, and I'm looking, and I said, what kind of musical language am I looking at? You know, I had been working on it for a long time, but I forgot that I'd been working on it, and I mm-hmm. suddenly looked at it as if I hadn't seen it before. Mm-hmm. You know, that happens with, mm-hmm. you can see a friend like that, or a dog, or anything, you see anything like that. But I saw the music like that, and I looked at it, and I said, I'm losing my mind, or what is this? And then I looked at it and I said, oh, that's my brain. That's how I think. And said, oh, that's okay. My brain's okay. It was a big relief to me to realize that what I was doing was actually a function of what my training, my experience, my memory, what I bring to, I'm getting around to an answer. Slowly. When I sit down to work, I bring everything with me. Now, the difference is, you think that it gets easier when you go older? No, it gets harder. Because you know too much. When you're younger, in a certain way, it's easier. In another way, it's harder, too. Because you don't know, you can't sit still long enough to do the damn thing. Mm-hmm. You know. The biggest help for a composer is to be able to sit and work for 6 or 8 hours at a stretch. Let me tell you, that's a big help.
Yeah.
If you get nervous and have to go for a walk in 2 hours, you're never going to get to what's going on. We're talking about paying attention. Attention. Just being able to concentrate on what you're doing. So you say, let's get to the question, how do you begin a piece? Well, first of all, what you're bringing to the piece. Sometimes I've had the impression that it didn't really matter where I began. And I remember once I had a cat walk over to the piano and said, oh, that's a good beginning, and I wrote it down. You can get in that kind of mood, you know, where I'll start anywhere, it doesn't matter. You know, I'm sure that, you know, there are people who do calligraphy like that, boom, and then they draw. Poets work like that too. It's not a bad way to start.
No.
Because it's not the starting that's the problem. It's the what. It's I have an 11-year-old son, and he said, Daddy, I'm having trouble with my songs now. I said, what's the trouble? He said, well, the tunes are okay, but I don't know what to do. I said, oh, that's the problem called what happens next. He said,
right.
He said, that's a good problem. But now you have, you now have a real composer's problem, and we can talk about that. What happens next? That becomes an interesting thing. Now, there are a lot of ways you can do it. You can think about structure and the way that you've seen sonata form or ABA. There are all those forms. You can say, oh, I'll do that.
Well, let me for our final question, because we've got to keep Mr. Glass on.
I haven't gotten to the answer, but that's okay. We're going to leave it unanswered.
But no, certainly the question of what happens next is definitely something that's been also a current question, kind of in the composition studio.
Well, there are styles. I say the advantage of having a personal style is that you know what's coming next. The disadvantage of having a personal style is that you know what's coming next. Mm-hmm. It's both a help and a hindrance at the same time. Mm-hmm. It can limit you. It can rob you of the spontaneity and the possibility of a wonderful new piece. Mm. I had a teacher like that, Persichetti. I used to bring a piece and half finished. I know you want to get through this, but I have to tell you this. And I would bring pieces in to see him, and he said, oh, now you can do this. And the son of a gun would actually finish the pieces for me. It was so discouraging. So finally, what I did, I would go to my lesson, and he said, well, did you bring the string quartet? I said, no, I didn't. I said, you know, I got stuck. I haven't done it. Well, I was home running it. But I didn't. I would bring it in maybe a couple weeks later. I avoided the issue for 2 weeks. The third week, I would bring in a movement, and he said, you finished the movement? And he was very disappointed because he wanted to finish it. But we worked it out. Basically, I only showed him finished pieces after all. But you can do that to yourself.
Yeah.
You've robbed yourself of perhaps an opportunity.
Mm. Mm. Okay, so for our kind of final part of the journey here, there are so many different styles of music around now, kind of fusion styles and neo this and neo that. Where do you think we're going in terms of new music in Western and non-Western culture?
I listen to a lot of music by young people because I got involved with some concert series in New York, and I just heard three pieces by people in their 20s. They're all different. I thought they were beautiful. I really liked them. We're in a very interesting period for new music right now. People in their 20s and early 30s, it's a very good time to be writing. In a way, it begins with John Cage. John Cage gave us permission to do all kinds of amazing things. He basically gave us permission. Then he gave us permission not to write anything, actually. And he framed 4 minutes, 31 seconds, boom. Yeah, he framed it. That was it. The best thing that happens is that we've gotten over a lot of the schools of music, whether it was the cacophonic or the minimalist or the polyphonist or whatever you want to call it, or the tonalist for that matter. What I'm hearing now is a kind of a freedom from all of that. It's a terrifying freedom in a certain way, but freedom always is terrifying. I think there's a lot to be learned from knowing the past. If you don't know the past, you're doomed to repeat it. And it's really sad that someone shows me a piece of minimalist music, which I threw away 30 years ago. And it's not new. It's not even interesting. Why would I want to hear something that I already wrote? You know, it's not a compliment even. It's just, I don't care. I don't care what they're writing, but I would rather it was something that they wrote. What I'm finding in the people are there's one young fellow I know who's inventing technology, making sounds, and just using those sounds to make compositions. But I heard a person wrote a beautiful piece for voice and double bass. Beautiful piece. I think, where is music going? I think it's going to a world which I'm very in favor of, a world of independence. Independence from schools, independence from styles, independence from criticism, independence from our teachers, whom we need to a point.
Yeah.
And then we don't need them anymore. But you'd be surprised. I mean, I'm surprised myself at how long it took me to get over Boulanger. It took me 20 years before I could write Parallel Fist again. I mean, you know, I finally said, okay, I'm going to break all the rules all over again. I think we're heading to a place where it'll be an exercise in talent, in spontaneity, but delivered with a command of technique, which, look, I've seen this in dance. Young dancers now are dancing better than they did 30 years ago. The training is better. You know, when I was working with Twyla Tharp a long time ago, people were either, you could tell from the shoes they wore, either were tennis shoes or bare feet or they were toe shoes, that dancers knew what it was by looking at the shoes. Well, they don't know that anymore. And a good dancer can dance in all kinds of styles. They can dance, they could be in a Merce Cunningham dance, they could be at the American Ballet Theater, they could be anywhere. We're in the place now where we're teaching very well. There's the landscape of music, where we're no longer looking at an arrow to the future, an arrow that music has to go there. Of course, that was a huge misapprehension, that in the 60s, we were told, maybe you were old enough to remember that, we were told where the history, where the future of music had to be. And you know what? We went somewhere else. And that was the end of that.
Yeah.
But I think we're over that, the idea that there's an arrow that points to the future. Mm-hmm. There's no arrow. Mm-hmm. However, there's craft, there's technique, there's talent, and there's poetry. And if with a little, you know, luck is not such a bad thing.
Agreed. Well, fabulous. I think we've been very lucky to be able to share this time with you. I can't thank you enough for carving out this period in your schedule.
I'm happy to be with you.
But thank you very much indeed, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this Rosemary McGee Creativity Conversation. This podcast was brought to you by Emory University and Arts at Emory. It was produced by Emma Yarbrough and me, Maggie Becker. Be sure to check out our other podcast episodes and follow us on Facebook at Arts at Emory and on Instagram at Emory Arts.